Our first speaker this evening is an individual that hardly needs an introduction. I am privileged to call him one of my close friends, having known him for a number of years. I first met Tom on the West Coast some 7 or 8 years ago. And our paths have crossed on numerous occasions all over this continent since that time. And on each and every occasion when I have been able to spend some time with Tom and have him share his wonderful AA program with me, I always leave that meeting feeling a little wealthier in the AA program. He is a ex. He's a past member of the Board of Trustees. He is a wonderful guy and a great AA member. I give you Tom B. of Winnipeg, Manitoba.
I'm Tom Breen and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. If you can feel what I can feel, we're all about to come unglued. Thank you, Jim. Dear Lois. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and Al-Ateen and Al-Anything else. I don't know how I got here. And if I find the guy that did it... We've been talking about miracles Marty has last night, and Wesley and Jim. And for a guy that came to this program, stuttering so bad he couldn't put two words together, feeling so lonely he felt he was all by himself in the business of living, so scared I could hardly get out of the house or out of bed, so fearful that I jumped if you snapped the aspirin box. And to find myself up here looking into 24,000 eyeballs and talking, nobody ever has to convince me about the God is dead bit. Because there's only one thing in the world to get a monkey like me where I am tonight. And that is the grace of God. And that is the thing that has got all of us here. Because it's purely and simply the grace of God that permeates the people who shared with me and cared about me long enough for me to get my brains out of hock and find out where I was and who I was. And I got a letter, and they said, you're going to get a 30-minute talk. And I said, I wish you luck. But what a rare privilege to feel the love and the sharing coming up from you to me, and to look into 12,000 smiling eyes, because that was the thing that brought me back to my second meeting. It wasn't of all the profundity that the old boys shared with me the night while I was leaping around the club room. It was the look they had in their eyes that brought me back, those smiling eyes. And brother, we got them here tonight. When we in AA don't have the corner on the smiling eyes, the Al-Anons have got smiling eyes and the Al-Ateens. And thank God for those people, because they've rounded out my life very much. I'm supposed to tell my story. And that's probably my favorite subject. In my country, we have what we call, I'm from Canada, we have what we call at random meetings, and they're a very dangerous exercise, where the chairman is appointed about 30 seconds before the meeting starts, and he puts the finger on a few drums. And he puts the finger on Joe, and Joe comes up and said, my name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic, and I started drinking at the age of 10, and instantly it becomes competitive. And Mary gets up, and she's got to start drinking at 9 and lie a little, or she's lost the fight. And the next one is 8 and 7 and 6. And if you don't run out of drunks, you wind up with a prenatal alcoholic. Now, I told that story in Louisville, Kentucky a few years ago when I was there with Marty, and Marty got up the next morning, or the next afternoon, and she said, "That ain't funny." Because apparently there are instances in medical history of babies being born of mothers who've been very heavily under the influence of alcohol over a period of time, where the child has gone through withdrawal symptoms 3 hours after being born. How would you like to be born half in the bag? I was not born half stiff, but I was born thirsty. I suspect that I had all the qualifications that it takes to make up an alcoholic, and at the age of 14, I added the booze, and you had one. I started drinking at 14 for no other reason than that's when somebody handed me a bottle of beer. And then it was my father. My father was a guy 6'2½", 250 pounds, successful man, dynamic guy. I lived in his shadow. I hated the ground he walked on. As a result of an incident that had happened a few years before. I only became aware of this not too long ago. And I was not a courageous person. I am not a good hater. I've never seen a drunk who was a real good hater. We work on it desperately, but we're not very good at it because our stomach won't allow us to be a good hater. Thank God for this. And he was with me. And while I was with him, we were driving in the country. He stopped on the side of the road. He said, I was nearly as big physically then as I am today. A big tank sort of guy. And I had a little more on the top and a little less around the middle. But smart as hell and good looking. He looked at me and said, we run out of pop. Do you like a bottle of beer? And I said, fine. He uncapped one. He gave it to me. I took a taste. I didn't like it. I thought, Lord, what did they see in that stuff? So I took another one and found out. I drank the first beer and I stole the second. You learn very quickly. We are born with larceny in our hearts and everywhere else. I took two bottles of beer. I walked around the car and my father was standing up. Remember, 6'2½", 250, 60 pounds. My first two bottles of beer, to my knowledge, in my life, I walked around the car and I looked at the old boy, and there he was, and a wonderful thing had happened to him. He'd shrunk. He come right down to my eyeballs, and I thought to myself, what have I been worrying about you for all this time? You don't look very tough or mean or smart, and I proceeded to tell him so, and that was my first mistake as a practicing alcoholic. Because the next morning I made a terrible discovery. I think if you could make the second one first and the first one second, you may be all right. But unfortunately, we make the first one first, and that is that booze does something for us. That booze allows us to live comfortably with the people and conditions and circumstances that we can't live comfortably with on our own resources. I was a left fielder from the day I took my first breath. The next morning, Father got up and told me, and I took a look at him, and my God, he was all grown up again. Now, we've heard a lot of talk about the brilliance and the intelligence of the alcoholic, which always gives me a bit of a chuckle. I've written a few pamphlets, and I always inserted that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I don't believe it, but I insert it anyway. That's good for our image, I suspect. So I thought to myself, what is it that I had yesterday that allowed me to handle that monkey that I haven't got today? The answer was two beers. I took two beers. Donnie came. Then if it'll handle father, it'll handle mother and conditions and people and circumstances. And I slowly but surely broadened out the influence that alcohol had in my life. It was not a problem in my life at that stage. It was an answer. It was an answer. The wrong answer, but it was an answer. I liked the taste, the smell, and the effect. I've met people who couldn't stand the taste. They had to hold their nose. And I give you marks for that. I loved it. Every bit of it. Every kind. I have a relative in now who's been... He's the only one in my family who's an alcoholic. All the rest of my family are social drinkers or non-drinkers. And he's training. And he trained himself into the local pokey not long ago. And I asked him, I said, have you seen any social drinkers when you were in the local jail? Did you meet any social drinkers in there for drinking? And he says, I don't believe so. I said, what were they in for? He said, writing checks or picking pockets or doing whatever social drinkers do to get in the pokey. And I said, you never met a social drinker in there for drinking. He said, no. I said, I'd dwell on that for a while if I were you. It's beginning to look like you're running out of reasons. I continued. Alcohol to me was like any addictive drug, I suspect. It took more to get the same effect over a period of time. Where it said 14, it took 2 beers to get Father down where I could handle him in the conditions and circumstances and for me to be comfortable, because I think comfortable is the name of the game. I think comfortable is the name of the game psychologically when we're drinking, and I think it's definitely the name of the game sober. If you and I can find out of this program a way of living and a dependency on each other and Almighty God that allows us to live comfortably without a drink, to function in the business of living, then by God we have an answer. And it's there, and we know it. Because all I have to do is lift... It doesn't take very long for me to grow into compulsive addiction and alcoholism. At the age of 19, I was diagnosed by the medical and psychiatric profession of my community as a chronic alcoholic, whatever that is. I immediately told the doctor at that stage of the game when we were sitting discussing me. You notice they always discuss me. Everywhere you go, they're discussing me. I said, I suggest that you go back to school, doctor, because it has become most apparent to me that the university that you got your last medical degree at was not up to snuff. And I suggest when you go back, you go to another one and learn something. And he told me where to go, and I went. I tried everything in my power, but booze was good. Booze was wonderful. Booze was not a problem. It was an answer. I used it. I slowly found myself. I was the kind of a guy at a speech impediment, terrible speech impediment, which I've recovered from more than adequately. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, or whatever this thing is named, when I came to AA, my sponsor, who's sitting right down in front here, told me, now is the time, my boy, to take the cotton batten out of your ears and put it in your mouth for 6 months. I took it out of my ears and put it in my mouth for 6 months, took it out at 6 months, and it had never been back in again. And I haven't shut up since. Booze did to me, it moved me from the fringe right into the middle. I was a guy who would stand along the side at the high school dance, and I couldn't get my shoes moving. And I wanted to be in there where you were, where the action was, where the swingers were, and I just couldn't do it because I couldn't talk, because I couldn't do anything. And some monkey would come along and say, what are you doing, Tom? I said, nothing. I said, have a drink. I had a drink right in the middle. Now, nobody's going to convince a guy like me that that stuff is bad at that stage of the game because it's good. But it got worse and worse very quickly. It took so much to get the same effect. You know, you'd figure if 2 beers would get your old man down where you could handle him, 4 would get him a little lower, and 8 would get him. You didn't run out of beer, you could get rid of them altogether. But it doesn't work that way. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, 2 days before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the amount of booze I drank was enormous, but it's not important. But it was enormous, and I couldn't handle the situation any better at that stage, probably worse than I did the day I took my first 2 beers. I went steadily downhill. I tried geography. I went into business with my father, which was a disaster, which he became aware of, and sold the business before Junior blew it. I tried geography. I decided that booze wasn't my problem, Winnipeg was, and I'd go to Vancouver with a case of whiskey to settle my drinking problem. And on the way, I'd stop in Calgary and get off and go into the pub to have a beer to think about my drinking problem. I'd meet all the drunks coming from Vancouver going to Winnipeg to settle theirs. And we'd get stiff together. And I'd go to Vancouver and San Francisco and Seattle and Los Angeles and Dallas and into New Orleans. I always wound up in Maurice's joint. And they kept throwing me in the pokey down there. They're very narrow about sleeping on the street in New Orleans. That's about the only thing they're narrow about. In New Orleans. I'll go to any lengths to prove that I'm not what I am, because I grew up in an atmosphere that said, if you can't drink, you're not mature. If you can't drink, you're not a man. And you and I are not about to be anything else. So I kept drinking and drinking and drinking and getting worse and worse and worse. But very early in our addiction or whatever it is, we come to feel way down deep where we live the things aren't good. I'm doing it a little differently from those monkeys. And something's going wrong. And people begin to look at us a little differently, if they look at us at all. And you know, there's a strange paradox in the life of an alcoholic, where that stuff moves you originally from the fringe of the human race and the fringe in the business of living into the middle. If you keep drinking, it starts to move you out again. And if you keep, it'll move you right out. But, you know, logic is a beautiful thing if you don't try to use it. When I started to drink my way from the middle where I wanted to be back out again, I stopped and thought, what was it that got me from the fringe into the middle? And the answer was booze. So when you start to slide out again, you're going to come to the conclusion that, by God, the only way I can get back in again is to drink a little more. And you drink a little more, and instead of going back in, you go farther out. Now you've got a problem, baby. And it's a disaster. The fear. People talk to me, my relatives, I have clergy relatives who've broadened out considerably since I got sober. They talk to me about hell, and I was an authority on it. They tried to help desperately. Psychiatrist said, Tom, if you don't get 19 years old yet, said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to go insane. If he hadn't used the word go, he'd have had me. The go, give me a little training time. The doctor says, I'm built like a Mack truck. He said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. I thought, oh, brother. So what? You ever try and scare an alcoholic into getting sober? That's an exercise in futility. But way down deep where I live, inside, I knew very early that something was wrong. But the very thought of giving this thing up, the very thought of being unhooked from the thing that made my life comfortable was absolutely beyond my comprehension. No way could I think this. This is why I think alcoholics reject help. We're not, you know, we don't reject help when people say, can't you see what you're doing to your job, to your family, to your health, to your sanity, to your wife and kids, your self-respect and your human dignity, and we tell them to drop dead. We don't do that because we're stupid entirely. I think we do it because we're defending a way of life. A way of life that, regardless of how unbearable it may appear to be, or be making those lives of the people around us, it's the only way of life at that second that is bearable to me, and I will defend it virtually unto death. Now, don't tell me that's a bad habit. That's a disease. I believe this. And I tried desperately. I tried cooling off and warming up and switching drinks and all that exercise. Mother told me once that if you didn't take the first one, you'd be all right. So I poured two out, and I poured the first one out and poured the second and drank the second, and I got just as drunk as I had when I drank. And I drank the first one. I knew she was lying anyway. Every now and then the idea would possess me that maybe the only way I would look in the eyes of the people I love, my God, that's a terrible exercise. Or they would look at me in the morning. I never got up in the morning to hurt the people I loved. I got up in the morning not to hurt the people I loved, but I couldn't function without that sauce. And as soon as I took any on, I broke their hearts again and again and again. And I didn't want to do this. And I didn't want to be where I was. And I didn't want to do the things I did. But I didn't know how not to do them. I didn't know how not to do them. And I'd go to any lengths to be what I wasn't. If you said, you're an alcoholic, why, you can't quit, I'd quit just like that. You drink whiskey, stick to beer. And I stuck to beer for about 30 minutes. My mother told me once after I'd been away on an excursion, an alcoholic survey, we used to call them in those days. She said, I wound up in Key West. You got to wind up in Key West. That's the end of the line. And I won my way to back into South Miami, and I'm sitting in a bar, 19 years old, 10:30 in the morning. My mother, who I hadn't seen her only child for about a month, walked into the bar. A crummy, sleazy bar. How she ever found me, I'll never know, and I've been afraid to find out. She walked up to me, and thank God, you know, the people who love us, those of you who love us say the damnedest things at certain times. She walked up to her only child, sitting on a bar stool, drinking a whiskey sour at 10:30 in the morning, shaking so bad he couldn't sit, and she walked up and she said, what time is it? I said, I don't know what day it is. She said, what are you drinking? She said, a whiskey sour. She said two things off the top of her head to try and turn this guy on or off who she loved. She said a whiskey sour is an alcoholic's drink, which is not, and only alcoholics drink in the morning. That was when I was 19 years old. I got sober in my late 20s. From that second until now, I never drank another whiskey sour. For the next 9 years, I drank everything that was too thin to chew, but no way would you get a whiskey sour down my throat. Now, I started thinking about when I looked in the eyes of the people I loved that maybe the only way I could help those people was for me to get rid of me. And I'm not a courageous drunk, I'll tell you. I'm a gutless wonder and still am. Without you and Almighty God, I am a mess. And I thought I'll do her someday. I'll think on that and get drunk and think on it. And I remember I was at home and I got out on about a 4-day little jaunt to inspect the city. And I came home at night. And this was when I was 22 or 3 or 4, I forget. And I came in the old family home, and Mother had the girls in for bridge. Now, the girls were all those beautiful old ladies that you and I grew up with that we called Auntie. Now they're beautiful people. In those days, they were nosy old bags who were always catching me sneaking to drink. And I went in, and I've never played bridge. I've had a thing on bridge. I mean, it's really been a hang-up because it started a lot of fights in my home. My father was also an alcoholic and a bridge addict, and that's a bad mixture. And I walked in to give the girls a little advice. I was 4-day growth of beard, my dirty clothes, stinking like a polecat, and I walked in, and I fell in the bridge table. And I went down, and they went up. And I'm laying down looking up, and they're up looking down. And I see tears rolling down their cheeks, and I remember somebody, and I think it was my mother, said, "Get out of here." And my reaction was, "Well, that's a lousy way to treat your only child. After all I've done for you." Had a short conversation. I went upstairs just seething, thinking. And on the way up, it dawned on me, I'll fix you. I'll kill me. Sanity. It was the 20th of November. It was 20 degrees below zero. It's cold up there. I walked through my room. I went into the closet to check my clothes. I used to keep the little handy to pack around numbers in there. And I had a belt, and on the way through, I went through my room out and onto a balcony that we had built onto this house for some reason or other. And I thought, out on the balcony, I didn't notice the cold. I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll jump off the balcony. I was just delighted that I'd conjured this up and how hurt the people who loved me were going to be. Think about that. I walked back in. On the way back, I noticed I went by a full-length mirror and noticed I had my new suit on. I had it on for 4 days. I said, "Lord, I wouldn't want to get my new suit dirty," so I took it off and I'm in my shorts. I went back in and had a couple of belts, went back out and inspected the scene. Went back in again, had another belt and went back. I'm just delighted. I could see the funeral, you know. Something wrong with a guy, you know, that does that sort of thing. And I walked out on the balcony. I climbed over the rail. I stood there for a minute, posing on this, and I let myself down, hung on the eaves trough, and let go, and fell 3 feet into 6 feet of snow. I got up, brushed myself off, and rang the doorbell. I'd left my key behind. I don't know about your shorts, brothers, but mine got pockets in them. My mother came to the door, and here's the prodigal standing just as blue as can be. And she said, "My God, what have you done?" And I said, "I just jumped off the balcony." And she said, "Oh, you poor dear," and I had her. I don't tell that if she's here because she failed to see the humor in it. Even with her Al-Anon experience. It wasn't long after that I ran out of everything. I couldn't stand it another second, and it was New Year's Day, 1956, that I went to a party of a friend of mine who I used to drink with. He was younger than I was. My argument was, of course, that I was too young to be a drunk. And I walked in, I'd heard this guy had lost his wife and kids. He'd wound up on Skid Row in Toronto. He'd joined something called AA and was on his way back. I went into a party. I tripped over the front stoop, slid into the party on my navel, Everybody said, "There's Tom." They were used to it. I picked myself up. I went into the kitchen, and there was Bernie. He'd been sober 6 months in AA. We had not much to identify one with another with as far as the business of living was concerned, but he did knock the argument that I was too young because he was a year younger than I was. He was smiling, and he was up to his eyeballs in booze. He poured me a drink. I went in, took one drink. I went back and sat down. Went back in and tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Bernie, I want to talk with you." He said, "Shoot." I said, "Not here. Somebody might hear." I didn't want him to know I had a drinking problem. I just arrived on my belt. He said, "We'll go downstairs." He opened the door to the damnedest set of stairs. I said, "After you." His foot hit the bottom. I had my hand on his shoulder. I said, "Bernie, how in the hell do you quit drinking?" And he turned around and laughed. And he nearly got it. If I could have picked my arm up, I think I might have hit him. But he laughed differently than anybody. I'd asked, "How do you quit drinking?" And everybody talked to me about backbone, willpower, standing up and being a man, outward manifestations of inward frustrations, and quack, quack, quack. Which didn't make any sense. They tried, God love them, they tried as sincere as they could be. They were caring with me, but I didn't turn on. This guy turned around, he had a look in his eye that I'd never seen before, but I see 12,000 times tonight. He had a smile on his face that was warm. Don't ever lose those smiles. Don't ever let these monkeys in this society tell you, "This is a serious business, and you're getting too humorous." To hell with them. I am totally and completely convinced that God in his infinite wisdom knew what he was doing when he gave drunks a sense of humor, not only for their survival, because we do laugh, you know, to keep from crying, but because that is the vehicle that we use to communicate God's love one from another. I believe this as I believe I'm here. I thought I knew what I would expect when I came in to see you at my first AA meeting. I thought you'd all be sitting around with your head on your navels, feeling sorry for yourselves because you couldn't drink, but you weren't. You were all laughing and cackling and chuckling, and I went and I was like somebody the other day. I sniffed a few of you just to make sure you weren't half in the sack, and because I didn't mind somebody quitting drinking, but God, if you quit drinking and got happy, I hated your internal working. But this guy smiled. He didn't talk about backbone and willpower. He talked about hopelessness and loneliness and fear and futility and guilt and remorse. And he built a bridge of understanding with me the like of I've never experienced before or since. And I walked over. And I walked into your arms and into your presence and into your love. And when I walked in, you were there smiling again, like idiots. You smiled through your eyes and your face and your hands. And I thought, God, if this is the way this thing makes you, then I want it. I had to quit drinking. I wanted to quit drinking. I didn't think it was going to be fun. I thought it was going to be a frightful experience. The only people I knew who didn't drink were those long, hatchet-faced old... dolls. I had a couple of, I thought, Lord. But they laughed and they, right from their bootstraps, and I thought, God love you. I said, what do I do? They said, walk with us. Walk with us. You told me about the serenity prayer. The only thing, two things I had trouble with accepting that I couldn't change. Number one was the fact that I was only 28 years old. And then I could never drink again, but you've got a daily program of living and thinking that allows me to handle that. It's called the 24-hour program. And the other thing that I couldn't stand was the fact that all the yesterdays that I was carrying around with me, those lousy, rotten yesterdays, the people I hurt, the hearts I broke, including my own. How do you unhook from those all those lousy yesterdays? And we got a philosophy of life and a program that allows us to do this called the 12 Steps of AA. We can put yesterday where it belongs and draw from it the things we have to. And look and see that the rest of it was necessary for to get us where we are today. So we could enjoy life and be of a little service to God and man. Thank God. We're truly the luckiest people on the face of the earth. There's just no doubt about this in my mind at all. But the thing that impressed me more than anything else when I walked in the door, alcoholics have a loused-up receiving set. The people who transmit their love and affection, be it the doctor, the psychiatrist, the psychologist, the wife, the kids, the in-laws, the outlaws, the mother-in-law, most of them do it in love. And they transmit accurately, but our receiving set's fouled up. Our receiving set's got a nut or two out of missing. And we always get a judgmental thing. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw the smiles, and I saw the laughter. And I got a feeling after a day or two, because, you know, drunks have got an antenna. God Almighty sticks out there like a beetle. We're just waiting for somebody in our first AA meeting to say, "Aye, aye, here he comes, the phony slob." And you laugh and you cry, and we're suspect of you. And we're waiting for you to say, "Who did you hurt? Where have you been? You've been in jail, been in the nut house, quack, quack, quack." And I'm waiting there, and nothing happens. The thing that impressed me about you, and my God, if we ever lose it in this fellowship, we're dead. What I found was a total lack of moral judgment on your part that gave me sufficient emotional elbow room to stay around until I could start to look at myself and judge myself and see what I had to do to clean this mess up. If we ever lose it, we're dead. And I've been in a few groups where they've lost it. They start to judge the minute some poor drunk comes in. Ah, there's a phony. He ain't going to make the program. And half the time it's the janitor, and he ain't even a drunk. Oh, we're beautiful. We're the great inventory takers, but it's usually the wrong ones. I love to. I took Marty's inventory a couple of times. There was a few days she was in a hell of a shape. So wonderful to see her and be with her. And I walked up the steps with you. I was stupid when you told me to do something. I did it, and I thank God for my ignorance. I came in believing in God, but having no faith in anything but dollar bills and whiskey. And they let me down. I hadn't run out, but they let me down. I couldn't solve my problems. I couldn't buy love and understanding and affection and all those things that I had to have. And I came in, and I got a little itty-bitty feeling right in the beginning. Maybe the only thing I'm going to get out of this is not the ability to not drink. Maybe I'm going to be of use. Ross said, "Clean an ashtray, clean an ashtray." I thought, isn't this fabulous? Nobody had ever asked me to clean an ashtray for 5 years because I'd have dropped it sure as hell and broke it. They quit asking me to do the dishes at home. That was a disaster. You know, a drunk doing the dishes. Like a juggling act. And oh, boy. And I walked with you. And I found what you had. And you kept smiling. Even when you were bawling me out, you were smiling. You're the damnedest bunch I ever saw in my life. My sponsor can just peel me like an onion and never stop smiling. Chuck C. can phone me, collect from Los Angeles, and take my inventory. Tell me for 30 minutes what a slob I am, and then say, "Well, goodbye, I love you." You're nuts. But, oh, boy, it's good. Because we find something in here. We find a comfortable way of living. We don't find a life free of problems and free of hang-ups and free of troubles. Nowhere in the book do I see that if you join AA, everything's going to be coming up roses. I've suffered more emotional pain since I've been here than I ever did before. I haven't got the tranquilizer now. I can't take a drink to get rid of the pain now. But you've given me a way of life that if I walk hand in hand with you, I'll be able to surmount anything that comes down the pike, and that's what my book tells me. It doesn't tell me, "Tom, you're going to have no more troubles." It says if you walk with one hand in ours and one hand in God's, it just doesn't matter one bit what comes down the pike, baby. You're going to be able to handle it and not take a drink. That's all it says. Oh, my. And then you get elected to something and you become an instant target. And that's good training. and the love and service for a while kind of floats out the window while the group takes your inventory. But that's good, because you find out that they're taking your inventory because they care about what you are told to look after. That it is important to them, and they're going to make sure you do it right. And it is important to us. It's our very life. And I walked up the stairs. And all of a sudden, I decided I'd better try to do a little praying. And I went home, and I closed the door and turned off the lights and locked myself in my bedroom, pulled the blinds down, laid flat in my back, and felt like an idiot. And said, God, if you're there, and he was, because I haven't had to have a drink. And that's the only way I know. I can get up in the morning and ask him for help and guidance and direction and go and do the best I can with what I've got, and I thank him at night. I get troubles up to my eyeballs, but I never think of taking a drink, don't you know? It just doesn't enter my mind to take a drink. And I surrounded myself with tough people in this business who told me what I had to hear in love, not because what I wanted to hear. And thank God for this. And I didn't do this out of a great burst of genius. There wasn't anybody else around, and they were kind of a homely-looking bunch. And I surrounded myself with them. And it's been good. One of the great things in the business of living is the privilege to serve. Where an alcoholic, maybe for the first time... There it goes. Is that five or what? Is that five? Oh, there's strange things happening up here. I felt maybe I was useful. And I've been able to serve because you've allowed me to serve here and there and everywhere. And I served a couple of times when you never even asked me and you threw me out. You haven't done everything the way I thought you should, but you've done it the way you were supposed to, according to God's wisdom and your, as it shows itself through our group conscience, thank God. There's a little story that I love, and I'm going to close and say goodbye. And I think it has something to do with us. If Austin is here, he'd know it, because the guy he works with wrote it, Ken Scudder, who was at one time associated with Clinton Duffy in San Quentin. It's the story of the little guy. It's called Forgiveness, the Saving Grace. But I think in our case it may have something to do with surrender, of throwing in the towel and complete deflation at depth when we walk in the door. It's the story of the little kid that was in San Quentin prison and been in for some time. And while he'd been in there, he'd written home three or four times, and he tried to communicate with his mom and dad and the rest of the sisters and brothers, and they hadn't answered. And finally, the time was coming for his release, and he wrote a letter, and it went something like this, "Dear Mom and Dad, I've been in this place some time, and I'm getting out soon. I've written you, but you haven't answered, and I understand why, because I know how much it breaks your heart to think of me in here and to write to me in here. I don't want you to write back and answer me because of the same reason. But when I get out, I would love very much to go home. I know how I've broken your heart, and I know how I've dragged our name through the mud, and I know that there's nothing I've done right in my lifetime. But when I get out of here, I'm going to try and do the best I can, and if you can find it in your heart to forgive me, I'm going to catch the train out of San Francisco when they leave." And we lived in a Fresno area or someplace like that, 3 or 4 or 5 hours by train out of San Francisco. "And I'm going to catch the train. Don't write back. The train goes by that old outer field. If you can find it in your heart to forgive me, go out by that cherry tree by the railway track in the old outer field and tie a white ribbon on it. And if you don't forgive me, don't do it, and I'll understand if I don't see it, and I'll go on and you'll never see me again, your son, Jim." Well, the minute he mailed the letter off in those joints, of course, the mail has to go through a few hands, and it was looked at. This young man was known as kind of an uptight kid, and they said, "Better wake." And by not knowing whether anybody in the world cared, whether there was anybody in the world that loved him, anybody in the world that wanted him. And you and I know what that's like. That's the loneliness of the disease of alcoholism. And they watched him very carefully, and finally, Duffy said to Scudder, "You better go with this kid on the train. He might jump off the Bay Bridge." So the time came for his release, and of course they hadn't heard, they weren't supposed to. They took him to the train, they got on the train. He got on the train, he just went straight to his seat and glued his nose to the window. And he never moved except to go and be physically sick again from this terrible tension, this terrible not knowing whether there was anybody in life that'd give a damn about him. I know all about it. I know now they were there, but I didn't know at one time. And the train went on and went on, and he never left his nose from the window. And then they came to the outer field, and there was the cherry tree. And there wasn't one white ribbon on it. There was 5,000 white ribbons on it. It was a mass of white ribbons, and it was like somebody had pulled a plug out of this kid's tummy. And all the cold and the fear and the loneliness and the hopelessness flowed out. And through the simple act of forgiveness, as in our life, through the simple act of surrender to a fact in our life, flows in through other people. All the love and the understanding and the joyousness in the business of living. And this is what I found when I threw in the towel. You took me in your arms and you walked with me. And I've got sobriety. And I've got a beautiful family. And I've got a million friends. And I love you so much, by golly, I just can't understand. I can't see. And I've got a faith in God, the Father of life. I love you very, very much. Thank you.